they could put him forward.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Morning, Carla.
Morning.
The December 13th council hearing will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Novick?
Here.
Fritz? Fish?
Here.
Hales? Feltzman?
Here. Well, welcome, everybody. We're here today to have our public hearing on the inclusionary housing proposals. And we're glad to see you. We always just want to make sure you understand some of the basic rules of how we conduct ourselves. So when you do testify, you will be limited to 3 minutes or less. We'll see what the clock looks like as we get the testimony. And all you need to do is state your name for the record, unless you're a lobbyist, in which case you need to identify the organization for which you lobby. And we ask that you don't applaud or boo or hiss or anything like that, but instead signal your support by waving your hands or thumbs up or thumbs down. And with that, we will, Carla, could you read the items, please?
Item 1381, provide affordable housing through an inclusionary housing program, and 1382, provide affordable housing through an inclusionary program and update the multiple unit limited tax exemption program.
Well, thank you. I'll provide some opening remarks. 10 years ago, the Portland City Council took a controversial and bold step to ensure resources available for affordable housing by adopting an urban renewal set-aside policy. And that policy has for years provided the majority of our funding for affordable housing and has ensured that thousands of affordable units have been built in specific portions of our city. And now it's time to take things to the next level. Today we are considering a new tool that will create affordable units throughout the city, inclusionary housing, a step towards ensuring that generations of Portlanders will live in economically integrated neighborhoods. Inclusionary housing is a policy that would give working Portlanders the possibility of living in the neighborhood they work, something that used to be a reality, but is becoming more and more unattainable in large swaths of our city, areas like Mississippi Avenue, Alberta Street, Inner Division. Inclusionary housing is a policy that gives families and children the prospect of living in mixed-income buildings and an economically diverse neighborhood, which will improve their chances to be successful in life. Inclusionary housing will not solve our affordable housing crisis, but it is a critical step towards more affordable housing in our city now and in the future. Fundamentally, inclusionary housing is about opportunity and equity. We are a city that prides ourselves on planning well. We have worked hard to ensure that jobs are located close to where people live, and we have been succeeding. But we must continue to work hard to make sure that people can actually afford to live in our city near those jobs. We need to ensure that people who comprise our workforce have places to live and to raise their families. Inclusionary zoning gives us an opportunity to attain that goal. This council conducted a work session about 3 weeks ago, And given we did have a work session, we're going to invite Housing Bureau Director Kurt Krieger and Matt Schibold to provide a short overview of the policy before us today. They will be joined by Nora Lake Brown of DRA and Associates, Joe Zinder and Tom Armstrong from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability are also here if the council has questions for them. So before we begin testimony, I'd like to introduce a few amendments which we have distributed to all of you last week, and I believe there may be other amendments to be offered as well. So the first amendment I offer is, and I thought if we could get the amendments moved and seconded, then we'll move to the public hearing. The first amendment is a substitute ordinance for item 1379, containing a number of technical fixes to Title 30 and to Title 3. The second amendment is
Let's take these in order. Are there copies for the public?
Yeah, they're there. Carla has them.
So I'll second that amendment.
Okay. The second is an amendment to Title 33, containing technical fixes also. So I would move that.
I'll second that amendment.
Okay. Third amendment is to Title 33, adding the initial phased-in inclusion rate in Title 33. This was incorporated in housing documents, but not in the zoning code. Move that. Second it. Are there other amendments to members wish to put on the table for consideration?
Yes, Mr. President and colleagues, I have an amendment which incorporates the language that we adopted on parking minimums and linkage to inclusionary housing. And I would move this amendment.
I'll second for purposes of discussion and testimony. And Commissioner Novick has two amendments.
I have two amendments. One of them relates to the fact that we are the Bureau of Emergency Management is developing and council has heard about the possibility of requiring seismic upgrades to unreinforced masonry buildings, which is essential for public safety, would also be very expensive for the building owners. And we've had a lot of discussion with building owners about what kind of financial incentives we can offer to make it more feasible for them to do those upgrades. One thing that they could theoretically do is sell off the right to excess floor area to a willing buyer that has some use for it. So we have an amendment we worked on with BPS to allow development projects that do not trigger inclusionary housing requirements, in other words, commercial projects, to increase floor area through an historic resource transfer as an alternative to doing it through voluntary inclusionary housing bonus. So you could do either one. Not all unreinforced masonry buildings are historic, but a number of them are. So specifically, the amendment is added to 33.510.210, paragraph 5, except as required by paragraph B6 for projects that trigger the requirements of 33.245, inclusionary housing. Bonus floor area of at least 3-1 must be earned from the mandatory inclusionary housing bonus options before qualifying for other bonus transfer options. And then this is the critical part. For projects that do not trigger 33.245 inclusionary housing, floor area of at least 3-1 must be earned from the voluntary inclusionary housing bonus option or be transferred through a historic resource transfer before qualifying for other bonus or transfer options.
So I'll second this for purposes of discussion.
Thank you.
Okay.
The second amendment is based on a conversation we had at the work session with the consultants, with David Rosen and Associates. And we were talking about the fact that in the current market, it seems like it's mostly studios and one bedrooms that are being built. So if that's all that is offered as affordable housing, then there might not be any family housing. So they said that other jurisdictions have had an inclusionary housing requirement that's based on the number of bedrooms, not the number of units. And I called them up and said, if you had that as an alternative, would you have it be the same percentage, or does it give, or should it be a higher or lower percentage?
They said they thought the same percentage made sense.
So what I'm offering is basically giving developers the alternative, meeting the inclusionary housing goals, either by having 20% of the units or the total number of bedrooms. So the amendment is to amend Title 30.01.120 C1 and 2 to provide, quote, 20% of the units or total number of bedrooms configured into IH units.
Inserted into
30.01.120D7 to state, quote, when the IH units are configured based on a percentage of the total number of bedrooms within the proposed development, the IH units must provide two or more bedrooms per unit, consistent with the idea of family housing. And then amendment title 3.01.103.040C1 to provide, quote, percent of the number of units or bedrooms. And there's a directive to amend the administrative rules consistent with these code changes.
Steve, I haven't seen this amendment before. Have you talked to the Housing Bureau and to the sponsor about this one?
Yes. We're supporting.
All right, so we'll second it for purpose of discussion.
Okay, great. So we have the amendments on the table along with the ordinances. And now we'll invite up Housing Bureau Director Kurt Krieger and Matt Chabot to give a brief overview. And Nora Lake Brown, are you going to join them as well? Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, members of council. It's my great pleasure to be here. Housing Director Kurt Krieger, Matt Scheibold, who's Policy and Equity Manager for the Housing Bureau, and Nora Lake Brown, who is a principal with David Rosen and Associates. First, I'd like just to say that this culminates a year's worth of work on the part of the Bureau. It's one of the reasons I came to Portland in August of 2015. And I think we're on the threshold of doing something really significant for the city of Portland. But with that sort of editorial comment, I want to just quickly lay down a pattern of facts so that the record is clear. Many of these slides were discussed at the study session, so I won't dwell on them. But it is, I think, important to make sure that the public record reflects this background material. First, the Senate Bill 1533, of course, was a top priority of the city of Portland. It successfully passed in fewer than 35 days of the short session this year, 2016. And it set a stipulated requirement that mandatory inclusionary housing could only apply to households of 80% of median income and above. It applies to rental and for sale housing with 20 or more units, and the mandate can only apply to affordable units limited to 20% of all units. We were mandated to require a menu of incentives, including system development charge or fee waivers, financing and tax exemptions, and we were required under the state law to provide a fee in lieu option. That was the underpinnings of 1533. You might also recall that during the legislative session, Commissioner Saltzman brought to council a resolution which stipulated that we would have an evidence-based process that was full and inclusive. That evidence-based process began immediately after session in April when a panel of experts was convened. And I think it's important that you know that the panel of experts was drawn upon because of their expertise, either in advocacy or in development or in finance. and there was no effort to create a democratic process. This was a group of strong-willed experts with their own deals, their own proprietary interests, and their own representation within the community. So there was no effort to gain consensus of this group. I think that's an important thing, because had we tried to gain consensus, it would have been a very it would have been a very lukewarm proposal before you today. Instead, the panel of experts was advising the Bureau and by extension the Housing Commissioner so that the Commissioner could give you his best thinking. And together with the amendments proffered today, including those offered by Commissioner Novick, we think that represents a good compromise. So the panel of experts began first looking at a series of development prototypes developed by a subconsultant to David Rosen and Associates, DRA, Eco Northwest. And those typologies represented every conceivable mix of housing types from three-story to high-rise construction in each zone of the city. And the panel of experts was consulted on all the assumptions within that model, including profit and overhead assumptions, including land price assumptions, and including construction cost assumptions. And I think it's important to note that the market was peaking as we were developing this model. So I would say that we erred on the side of generosity when it comes to a profit and overhead, as well as land price and construction costs. From that series of development prototypes, DRA developed a series of modeling assumptions and developed the nexus analysis. You might recall that we were going to do a nexus study even prior to state authorization to do inclusionary housing, so we essentially did both simultaneously. From that, DRA brought back the analysis. The panel of experts met several times, debated, discussed, refined, and came to some conclusions. There was a great deal of interest in bench testing the assumptions against real projects, and the Housing Bureau was very open about that. The Housing Bureau offered to pay for that analysis ourselves, but we made it clear that if we touched those performas and analyzed specific private deals, that all that information would become discoverable as public records. So under that sort of knowledge, the private development industry did their own modeling, and several of those individuals will speak to you today about their conclusions based on their assumptions. I would say that not all the assumptions are apples-to-apples comparisons, that they made some different assumptions than we did and that DRA did. But nonetheless, I think it was able to validate in large part that we were very close to obtaining parity in the central city and that we had a ways to go with respect to the mixed-use corridors. And the amendments offered today, I think, close that gap in the mixed-use corridors. Then in September 2016, the program recommendations came forward, and we began the deliberation and discussion with the Planning and Sustainability Commission, which did unanimously recommend a due pass with a special attention given to the calibration of offsets. So that's the litany of what occurred over some 40 hours of public meetings over a seven-month period of time. There were probably three or four times that in private meetings with individual stakeholders to ensure that everybody knew what was going on. So this was very much an open, transparent process. And we were never constrained, I might add, by either cost or time. We had enough time to do our work. With respect to the policy framework, the citywide program is important to note that many jurisdictions, including Seattle, are only talking about inclusionary housing in portions of the city. We felt that it was important to have a citywide program that was synchronized with your implementation of the 2035 Comprehensive Plan, that if we are going to achieve some 123,000 new housing units, 10,000 of which are intended to be permanently affordable in your Comprehensive Plan vision, that this needed to be a citywide program. However, we needed to calibrate the incentives by specific geographies within the city because the real estate economics vary across the city itself by neighborhood. We felt it was important to set a mandatory program at 80% of AMI consistent with state law, but to provide further incentives to encourage developers to serve the 60% of AMI and below market. So you will see that those incentives indeed are attractive, and we did that intentionally. Secondly, we wanted to prioritize units on site over the acceptance of a fee in lieu or off site, which is quite different than many other jurisdictions. Several cities, including Seattle, actually have set their fee low enough to actually encourage developers to pay the fee rather than to provide the units. And we've said repeatedly that receiving the fee is not in the city's best interest because we then have to use that fee to go out and compete with the private sector to buy land. And there's often a 3 to 5 year time lag between the time we receive the fee to the time we can actually produce the unit. It's much more efficacious, much more efficient to tap the hydraulics of the private market and cause affordable housing to be developed where the private investment is occurring at the same time. That said, we are providing some options to do off-site and to provide, as the law stipulates, for a fee in lieu. We are intending that this policy would apply to all buildings with 20 or more units. This council may craft some narrow exclusions. That is certainly your right. We do intend that the inclusionary units be of comparable size, composition, and distribution throughout the building, not all within a sub-basement, not all on the north side of the building, not all on lower floors versus higher floors. And I do want to speak to the amendment proffered by Commissioner Novick, that we actually think the ability to combine units by bedroom and produce perhaps fewer but larger size units is really quite in the public interest, and we think that's a good joined-up thinking. One profound policy shift is that heretofore, the Housing Bureau is incentivizing through property tax abatement, short-term 10-year affordability, or through direct financing, tax increment financing, some 60 years of affordability. We think that's insufficient, and this new policy would essentially maintain units affordable in perpetuity for 99 years. And most importantly, as we calibrated the offsets, we wanted to make sure that we were not impeding the market rate development industry. So we very carefully looked at profit and overhead, land cost, development costs, including hard and soft costs, labor and materials, to make sure that we were not overburdening the industry. I'm sure people will comment on that today. With respect to the program recommendations, this applies across the board in the central city and in the mixed-use zones. The graphics of the portions of the city that applies are provided. Since single family is exempt, we obviously have exempted the majority of the city as a result. The inclusion rates include a initial in the mixed use zone, since a special concern was voiced at the study session about closing the gap, we believe that it was appropriate to have an initial rate of inclusion of 15% at 80%, and in 2019 that would step up to the standard rate of 20% at 80% of AMI. That allows 2 years for the market to adjust and the residual land values to come into alignment with real costs, since we know there's a lot of speculation in the current land market. There is a deeper affordability option, and that would be an initial rate of 8% of units at 60% of AMI, again stepping up in 2 years, 2019, with 10% of the units at 60% of AMI, which was our original program design all along. We've also come up with an alternative fee schedule, which recognizes that the fee in lieu could be tapered in, and that is before you today as well. So the offsets available as incentives in the mixed-use zone include the 3-to-1 density bonus, as we've discussed, a 10-year property tax exemption on the affordable units only, the exemption of construction excise tax on the affordable units, a waiver of parking requirements, and system development charge waivers on the affordable units if they are indeed under 60% of AMI. That's a very attractive package, as mentioned at the study session. Most cities have only offer FAR, or bonus density incentives. They don't offer direct financing. I work for Fairfax County, administered the Urban County Inclusionary Zoning Program there, and frankly, it was all done with incentive zoning. No money changed hands whatsoever. So this is a very compelling and well-balanced package. I was pleased to see the guest editorial by the Sightline Institute in the Oregonian this weekend, which recognized that balance in this approach is quite important. They didn't, of course, render an opinion as to whether or not it was correctly balanced or not, but they did encourage such balance. So I look forward to hearing the testimony about how we've done today. With respect to the central city, of course, this is a high opportunity area, an area where Portland really distinguishes itself because our central city is home to tens of thousands of people working against type in other large cities where the central cities are often business districts but not 24-hour neighborhoods. So we want to make sure that continues, but the cost of providing such housing is higher because of the high-rise typology. The mandatory inclusion requirement would apply on day one, February 1st, whereby 20% of the units would be affordable at 80% of AMI, and there would be an affordability option of deeper affordability at 10% at 60% of AMI in the central city. The offsets are somewhat different to recognize the higher costs and typology. Density bonus would apply. The 10-year property tax exemption would apply to all units for sites with a base floor area ratio of 5 or above, which we believe is warranted given the higher cost of development in the central city. The CET, or construction excise tax exemption, would apply on affordable units only, and the system development charge waivers would be made available for units under 60% of AMI. We modeled the issue of property tax incentives, and I believe the county will render an opinion about that today, which I look forward to hearing. With respect to options, we are allowing affordable units to be in new development, which would be our preferred option. There is a payment in lieu of performance, which we must allow. And we've provided several off-site options, which we think are magnificent opportunities for collaboration with nonprofits and for-profits in this community. One is to build new units or dedicated market units as affordable nearby. That location needs to be within a half mile, and it has to be an equal or better opportunity mapping score so that we're not exporting people to inferior locations, essentially creating a disconnect between jobs and housing and disadvantaging people's access to services and shopping. The units must also be comparable in size, quality, and bedroom count. Yes, sir.
What's the clock for meeting that obligation?
Is it three years? And I think I originally had some language, which I actually wrote, which stipulated that there needed to be a permit pulled, I think, before a CFO was issued for the sending unit property. The panel of experts said oftentimes the capital stack isn't really known at that moment in time, and they urged us to enact some fairly rigorous financial penalties for non-performance. So we're giving people 3 years to perform, but there are some significant financial penalties attached to their non-compliance. The other option that is not mentioned in the slide is that if if there is a property at risk of converting to market, an off-site option would allow a developer to extend the affordability of that property for the 99-year term that we talked about earlier. For example, if a tax credit project was at the end of its initial affordability requirement and could be marked to market, a developer could buy the partnership interest, assign that property to a nonprofit, and get credit for doing so as part of their project.
Is it worth considering what happens in the event of a significant change in market conditions, like a huge spike in interest rates or something else? We've been through something like that recently called the Great Recession, where the off-site option no longer pencils out, but we have an interest in maybe converting it to a fee in lieu or something so that we can add it to our toolkit and do affordable housing. Is it worth contemplating a situation where, through no fault of the developer's intentions, they don't meet the three-year deadline and we convert it to something where we get the resources and add it to our plan?
I think that's highly likely. We've talked about this as it relates to the building pipeline of some magnitude. I think we're approaching 16,000 units of vested projects that will vest prior to the February 1st date. We know that many of those projects will face an uphill battle with respect to increasing interest rates. They may not convert to market rate. So we want to be flexible and apply the 10% at 60% option to those pipeline projects so that they become potential voluntary inclusionary housing clients of the Housing Bureau. Moreover, we felt that after that pipeline had been sort of emptied out in 3 years, we would need to look again at Title 30 and the calibration, because we know interest rates, labor prices, and materials will all be different then. So we're open to looking at that. The rate of inclusion is in Title 33. That's a much more elaborate review process. Title 30 is more of a ministerial process and can be adjusted quite easily.
State my preference. I strongly support your priority in terms of on-site development that provides certainty and boosts opportunity. If the fee in lieu kicks in, I'm hoping that there is something of a disincentive to using it, but if it's the only option, we go that route. I think the off-site option is the least attractive. It requires, there's all kinds of variables in terms of market conditions. We can endlessly argue about location and compliance. And I think it puts burdens on the Housing Bureau in terms of oversight. So, again, I hope the way it's structured is strongly encouraging that the units go in the new development with a fee in lieu as an alternative so that that money comes to us and we can package it with other resources and actually make sure that the housing is being developed.
I appreciate that. Just for the audience knowledge, they may not have noticed that this year The Design Commission approved a density transfer for the Broadway Tower, which is an office at Columbia and Broadway next to Raven and Rose, the pub. And this is an office with a hotel combined. And in order to demonstrate public benefit for the FAR transfer, there will be 20 affordable housing units built in a 60-unit project immediately to the west on the South Park blocks. Those housing units will be affirmatively and fairly marketed to hotel service workers. So you have a workforce housing nexus between the hotel and the housing, which we think is quite compelling. It will be a candidate for the tax exemption, tax abatement multi-program. So we're already working on things like this. We would like to encourage it. And frankly, although Walt Bowen, the hotel developer, happens to be a housing developer, which is somewhat unique, to his credit, he can do both. But many private developers that are doing perhaps condos or not interested in doing affordable housing, they would ally most probably with a nonprofit partner to do the off-site housing on an adjacent site. So that concludes my presentation. If there are any further questions, we'd be happy to respond. Nora will be here for the duration.
Questions?
Yeah, I have three questions. I've been struck by the fact that everyone who's contacted our office, whether they're supporters or critics, are united in wanting to make sure that this proposal actually works. So I have three questions that go to the question about will this work as we anticipate. The first is the thousands and thousands of units that are beating the February 1 deadline. We're going to have probably the biggest bull market in multifamily development since I've been on the council. And what we know is that a lot of stuff is being filed that's not cooked. And a lot of folks are going to be scrambling over the 180-day period to complete the application. Ever the optimist, I'm hoping that there's a number of opportunities in that pipeline for the Housing Bureau to sit down with developers and negotiate a voluntary IZ or some enhancement for the public interest. None of us here know where the bureaus are going to land next year, and we haven't begun to lay out the budget process. But it seems to me, with the volume of units in the pipeline and with our goal of trying to negotiate some voluntary IZ in those units that are beating the deadline, you're going to need to have staff available to do that, and the Bureau of Development Services is going to need to have staff. So I want to just plant a seed for you to come forward and tell us what kind of resources do you need to be successful in that enterprise. Because again, we may very well see so many projects beat the February 1 deadline that for the next couple of years, the bulk of the development is done in this city that is not covered by IZ. And if we don't have the staff and the resources to negotiate voluntary deals, we're going to lose a lot of opportunity here. And I'd like to make sure that both the Housing Bureau and the Bureau of Buildings have the adequate staff to do that. That's number one. Number two, at some point today, are we going to get an update on the estimated costs of implementation with an eye towards impact on our budgeting, impact on the county's share of particularly the tax abatements, and as we know, we're still subject to a ceiling there, and then the unique impact of this program in urban renewal districts where there could be a significant change in how much resources we have in a couple of districts because of this. Are we going to get an update on that today?
I will say with respect to the tax abatements, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori will be here to testify on the tax abatement policy, but she won't be here till 10 o'clock. When she does arrive, we'll take her to the stand.
So my interest in asking this is both to have a sort of a preview of what we're going to have to be thinking about at budget time, but also understand some of the trade-offs. And they're not all costs that come out of our pocket. So I'm particularly interested in the county share, impact on urban renewal, and then what you view as the city share. And the third thing, Kurt, I want to just put on the table, and this goes to some of the folks that we've heard from who aren't sure that this is calibrated the right way. And frankly, I'm not in a position to really opine on that. You've convened a group of experts. We've had a thoughtful process. I'm prepared to move forward on this. But what I'd like to know is what are the canaries in the tunnel that we need to be keeping an eye on? What data will we be tracking to test whether this is the right package? And at what point in the process would you be, based on the data, potentially coming back to us saying, let's tweak this or tweak that? I'm particularly concerned about development that is on the east side that's under 20 units, which would be contrary to our comp plan and our climate action plan goals. And I'm also, frankly, concerned about the fact that there's so many units in the pipeline that we may not actually have good data overall because of the flood of projects which are going to beat the February 1 deadline. But what I'd like to know before we vote on this is, what data are you going to be tracking? And when will we know whether this is working or not? And what are the indicators that this council needs to monitor going forward, since we all share the goal of ensuring that this works?
Very good.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all. And we'll now move to, we have two invited panels. And as I said, when Chair Kefouri shows up, we will accommodate her. But the first panel is Vivian Satterfield of Opal Environmental Justice, Felisa Higgins of Service Employees International Union, and John Mulvey of the East Portland Action Plan and the Inclusionary Housing Coalition.
Mr. President, before we begin, I neglected to introduce a companion amendment to my amendment on family-sized units, sort of incorporating everything we said about Title 30 to Title 33.
I'll second that.
Thanks.
Thanks. Okay, Vivian, take it away.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Vivian Satterfield. I'm the deputy director at Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, and I'm thankful for this opportunity to speak to you today and thankful to finally be able to say Portland can and should enact the inclusionary housing proposal before you without delay. Opal's been working at the intersection of transportation, housing, and health for over a decade in our communities. In 2008, we began examining the root causes of housing injustice for communities of color and working class households. We identified inclusionary zoning as a critical tool used in other jurisdictions to make a community less racially segregated and more economically diverse. Inclusionary housing isn't difficult to understand. It is simply a tool to help maintain diversity and economic stability when housing markets fluctuate. There's only one reason why this tool was banned outright in 1999 at the state level. Profits were valued higher than people. Inclusionary housing has been under consideration in this state from the original ban to our successful repeal of the ban for nearly two decades. This includes the ongoing scrutiny of the development industry, which maintains that if we only had more time, we would arrive at a program, likely with an end result that would be more in their favor. Today's consideration is not a surprise. Rather, it has been a long time coming. And as we've waited, we've declared a housing state of emergency. We've documented through the excellent but sobering state of housing reports published by the Housing Bureau how unaffordable and exclusionary, especially along the lines of race, class, and household size, our city has become. We've observed the change in our neighborhoods as block by block, for sale, and new construction signs became ubiquitous in every quadrant. A lot of folks from the advocacy community and their members desperately wanted to be here this morning, but they can't. Some are in Salem sharing stories and furthering policy ideas with our elected representatives to address other aspects of our statewide housing crisis, such as renter protections and rent stabilization. Others are directly impacted by the lack of affordable housing, aren't here because they can't afford to take the morning off work. And then there are those who've been pushed so far to the fringes of our city due to the lack of affordable housing that what would have been a short bus ride down to City Hall to appeal directly to you in person has now become a complicated scheduling endeavor of multiple transit trips. It simply takes too long. We're appealing to every level of government because we must. And despite working with shoestring budgets, despite addressing the multitude of real and pressing threats to our community's livability in this city, we've been successful in unlocking the tools which this council can then use to address affordable housing production and housing choice, like the construction excise tax and inclusionary zoning. We're going back this upcoming legislative session for meaningful renters' protections and rent stabilization, and yes, we will succeed there too. Portland's housing crisis is amongst the worst in the nation, while we remain an attractive place for people to move. We must act with a sense of urgency to stop the resegregation of our communities where unaffordable housing is the only option being built. There are claims that this inclusionary housing proposal will stifle and even stop development entirely, that it will exacerbate an ever-worsening housing crisis. These claims are demonstrably false. Simply look to the 500 jurisdictions nationwide where some version of IZ already exists. Buildings are still going up. Resistance to inclusionary housing as a regulatory tool to address what the free market does not provide, again, comes because profits are valued higher than people. We've been prompted throughout this process to ask ourselves, what does a successful policy look like in other cities, and how do we replicate that? We should also ask ourselves, what does failure look like? And honestly, without further delay, it's inaction. Failure is a policy that lets one more day go by where our neighbors are priced out and profits are placed over people. Service workers and hourly wage earners are part of the fabric of Portland and must not be dismissed. Entire communities of color have dwindling places in Portland we can call home. We will know this policy is a failure if it allows rampant racial and economic resegregation to continue. We must ground ourselves in the reality of this type of failure is very real. We have an opportunity to steer Portland in a different direction despite toxic rhetoric at the national level. This city is filled with progressives who believe in inclusion, not exclusion. People who want to move forward, not backward. People who understand history's mistakes and want to learn from them, not repeat them. This current council has been given the opportunity to do so, to move Portland forward from its dark past of exclusion towards a more just future. This policy is based on 40 years of trial and error from across the nation, a process with community-organized forums and presentations informed by expert panels and experienced consultation. It is my opinion that before you today is the best form of inclusionary housing we can enact at this time. I urge you to take action without further delay. Maximize the policy as allowable under state law with no additional carve-outs or ramp-up periods. Our movement bears witness to how you vote on this most clear of choices. Will you stand with the profiteers and continue to enrich those at the top? Or will you say enough is enough? We've gone too far and too long without protecting the needs of those trying to find a small foothold of security. Before you is a most modest request, the chance to call home here in the city of Portland for our folks. Thank you.
Thank you, Vivian. Lisa Higgins.
Hello, President Saltzman, members of the council. Hi, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director for the Service Employees International Union. We're the largest union in the state of Oregon. We represent 65,000 workers throughout the state and about 11,000 who live in the borders of the city of Portland. It's very clear, I've been before you many times to talk about our workers and where they live versus where they work and what it means for them to get to and from their jobs. I want to start by telling a short story about one of our board members, Caitlin Doherty. She has two children. She's worked at Legacy Emanuel for 20 years. She's a surgical technologist there, which means she makes a good amount of money, actually. She makes about $22 an hour. And she has two young children. And Caitlin recently moved and had to move to Clackamas County because she couldn't afford to live in the city of Portland limits, and she makes $22 an hour. And she works at a hospital, which means her hours vary wildly. I think everybody here can agree we would like to have our hospitals open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which means they have to be staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And this has really been a challenge for Caitlin and limiting her options about what shifts she can pick up, how she can get to and from work. And it's also created disruption for Megan, who's in elementary school and has had to move outside of where she goes to school on a regular basis. And we know yesterday was in Salem with Children's First of Oregon, and they were talking about how when a child moves, it costs them a year of school. So the policy that you're looking at and envisioning today affects families like Caitlin in a very real way. It impacts her life and Megan's life and the future of our city in a very real way. We want to keep the workers who work here, here, close to where they work. I think the Central City Plan in the affordable and this inclusionary zoning policy is a critical plan for our members who clean the vast majority of the high-rises downtown, who are the security officers who guard those high-rises, who make between $10 and $15 an hour. For them to be able to afford to live anywhere near those commercial zones is just a blessing. And I think this policy goes a long way in really making that happen. They've waited a very long time for the market to correct itself. And that hasn't happened. And so the choice that's happening in front of you today is you taking a step forward again to correct the market. I really want to thank the whole council, but especially Commissioner Saltzman. You know, we have been down in Salem together many times, taking our lumps on this policy from people who may not agree. I know that over the last year, you've been here every day taking your lumps on this policy for the people who may not agree. And I think the process that you've put together to get us to the place where we're at today is, frankly, years of your dedicated and committed work. And the committed work of your staff. We wholeheartedly hope that the commission can adopt this policy today. Some of the amendments you have in front of you, I think, are also critical to making this policy more workable for working families. I think the amendment that Commissioner Novick has brought forward around expanding the number of bedrooms is really critical and important. I've been to many workers' houses over this city where you have 4, 5, 6 people in a studio, a one-bedroom, a two-bedroom apartment, because that's how they afford to live in the city, and that's how they can live even remotely close to where they work. I also think that, you know, today is your chance to live up to the promise of livability that was made, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, before many of you even got into politics, before I got into politics. But that commitment, I think, is still alive and well in the city of Portland, and we've promised a livable city, and that means a couple of things. It means affordable housing. It means good jobs. It means a place where you can live and work close together. And I think today's vote is another commitment and that affirmation of that promise that has attracted development, has attracted business, and has made us the city we are today. So I hope that we can count on your votes to keep that promise to Portlanders. Thank you.
Thank you, Felisa.
Felisa, none of us up here like to disappoint you, but I just want to clarify something. today's the first reading of an ordinance,
yes.
So the vote will be next week, and it'll also allow the entire council to participate. But so it's scheduled for next week because we have to let a week go between first and second reading. But that's not because
thank you, Commissioner Fish.
we're disregarding your challenge, so.
But there's enough votes today, right? No, I'm just.
We'll vote on amendments today.
Yeah. On amendments.
Great.
John Mulvey.
Good morning, commissioners. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. My name is John Mulvey. I'm a member of the East Portland Action Plan Housing Committee, and I've been closely following the inclusionary housing issue for more than 7 years. I've also been severely rent burdened, at times spending more than 90% of my monthly income on rent. And when that became unsustainable for the past year, I've been homeless, living on the streets of the city of Portland. For the past year, I've risen early from whatever doorway I've been sleeping in, went to the nearest Fred Meyer men's room to clean up, and ridden my bike to the monthly 3-hour meetings of the panel of experts, the group that you charged with advising you on the creation of Portland's inclusionary housing policy. As you know, local governments in Oregon were prohibited under state law from enacting inclusionary housing, despite it being a fairly non-controversial program in hundreds of jurisdictions nationwide. I've personally had dozens of conversations with legislators and been an active member of the statewide coalition that finally overturned that legal preemption earlier this year. The state preemption was lifted over the objections of the state's home builders. The developers' objections led to compromise legislation in which the state imposed a series of statutory restrictions, including limits on what cities can require and mandates on incentives that developers must be given for compliance. No other state micromanages how local governments must structure their IH programs, and these restrictions, written by the developers, ensured that Oregon's program would be unavailable to help the lowest income Oregonians, and it also renders large geographic areas of our state essentially off limits to the IH requirements, including much of East Portland. Last spring, at your direction, the Housing Bureau began monthly meetings of the panel of housing experts, most of whom were for-profit developers. The essential question that this panel was trying to answer was how to structure the incentive package so as to avoid inhibiting the creation of new homes in Portland, both regulated affordable and market rate. Everyone agrees with the need to strike the right balance of requirements and incentives to harness our city's dramatic growth and unprecedented increases in housing costs. The overwhelming majority of the time spent by the panel was devoted to answering that question. The Housing Bureau brought in David Rosen and Associates, a consulting firm that's advised on these identical policy issues in dozens of other jurisdictions. DRA spent hour after hour with members of the for-profit development community, hearing input on the assumptions that would underlie their economic analysis. Every cost, from parking to FAR bonuses to stick versus concrete construction, was debated at length so that the end product would reflect the right balance between public need and development realities. But a funny thing happened on the way to the council. A group of developers, not all of them, decided to abandon that attempt at balance and instead demand that the public fully offset their costs under the inclusionary housing program. Since the PHB released its proposal in September, we've seen a full-blown effort by this group to convince the public and this council to provide full public funding to meet their so-called development gap. Their argument is that the city should abandon the independent economic analysis that it paid for and instead use their analysis, which perhaps not surprisingly shows that they should be given millions in additional tax abatements and fee waivers. I was in this room back in the summer when you referred the housing bond measure to the voters, and at that time a couple of members of this council mentioned that before going to the voters to help solve the housing crisis, the city's leadership would ensure that other constituencies be part of the solution too. You mentioned inclusionary housing explicitly as a way of making sure that the development community, who have done so well while I and other Portlanders slept in parks and vacant lots, would have skin in the game. It appears that they were absent that day because they're here today not to put their skin in this game, but to demand their pound of flesh from the taxpayers. I urge you not to give it to them. Inclusionary housing has succeeded in creating thousands of homes for low-income people nationwide. There is zero evidence to support claims that it impacts housing supply or drives up market rate rents. Those claims stem from an erroneous assumption, which is that housing developers base their price on their costs. They do not. As your consultant, David Rosen, told you 2 weeks ago at the work session, and this is a quote, the cost of producing real estate is not related to its price. He meant that for-profit housing developers set prices by what the market will bear, not by a simplistic cost plus profit analysis. Individuals do that too. If you've ever sold a home, I'm guessing that you did not sit down and figure out how much the house cost you, how much you've spent to improve it, tacked on a modest profit, and set your price based on that. Of course you didn't. You looked at comparables in the market, and you picked an amount that you thought you could expect to get in the marketplace at that time. That's what for-profit housing developers do, too. That's precisely why a robust inclusionary housing program is so important for Portland right now. Enacting Commissioner Saltzman's proposal would harness the windfall profits that our wildly inflated housing prices are creating and put them to work to protect and strengthen our city. Without it, what was once called the most livable city in America becomes simply a crass real estate opportunity in which investors monetize our livability and walk away. That's not the way we do things here. Portland Way is to solve our housing crisis as a community, and a strong inclusionary housing program is an essential tool to doing that. So I hope you will support the strongest possible program, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you like.
Any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you all very much. And I'll call up our next panel, Dr. George Galster, who has a PhD in economics from MIT, presently serves as the Clarence Hilbury Professor of Urban Affairs at Wayne State University. Dennis Allen, representing LOCUS, a coalition of developers and investors, and Dr. Lisa Bates of Portland State University. Welcome. Dr. Galster, you're up first.
Thank you very much. It's my honor and privilege to participate in the discussions of this important proposed ordinance, which I believe will positively affect my new hometown for generations to come. Based on my over 40 years of analyzing metropolitan housing markets and reviewing the scholarly research, rigorously investigating the effects of inclusionary housing policies, I strongly endorse the proposed ordinance. Inclusionary housing ordinances were first enacted in the United States over 40 years ago and since have wildly proliferated both in geography and in their programmatic specifics. They're now in operations in hundreds of cities and counties across the United States, including fast-growing Portland-sized places like Denver and Minneapolis. Despite its long-standing track record and considerable number of scholarly evaluations, the debate over inclusionary housing here in Portland, from my view, has been shrouded in half-truths and myths, some unfortunately advanced by self-appointed experts who have purported to summarize scholarly research, but in fact have misrepresented these findings. I know that some people believe that there are no such things as facts anymore. Needless to say, I strongly dispute that. On the contrary, respected researchers whose methods have passed exacting peer-reviewed publications have come to a consensus about what inclusionary housing ordinances, such as the one being considered in Portland, will in fact do. They will, number one, increase the supply of housing affordable to moderate-income households. Two, they will not reduce the rate of new housing construction. And number three, they will not raise overall housing prices, only perhaps, if at all, in the luxury end of the housing market. Now, my task this morning is to explain briefly why researchers have come to these conclusions. And I would add for the council that my full testimony includes the citations of the scholarly literature that I will be summarizing. I shall proceed by debunking four myths that keep cropping up in the discussion over the proposed Portland ordinance. Perhaps some people think that by repeating these myths loudly and often enough, they will acquire the veneer of truth. Myth number one, inclusionary housing will slow the production of housing. Now, this could only occur if the proposed ordinance made developing housing absolutely unprofitable, not simply less profitable. Now, will this ordinance make housing unprofitable? No. Even with this ordinance, developers will make handsome profits for three reasons. One, the demand for luxury housing is growing so quickly that developers can't keep pace with it as is. Two, thus they can raise their prices for their luxury customers to offset their loss of revenue from the set-aside units. And three, on top of that, they will receive a variety of generous financial incentives from the city, which we've just heard. Now, research from the scholarly community shows that there is virtually no impact on total housing production with the sort of inclusionary housing policy that Portland